Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
This is Sherry Bayer from All in the Industry. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Greetings and welcome to another episode of Animal Instinct here on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Celia Kutcher, also known as the Food Healer, and today I've got Denise Herman in the studio with me today. She's the owner and lead trainer of Empire the Dog in New York City, and we're going to talk all about the recent shift in dog training techniques. So, Denise, how are you today?
I'm well, Celia. How are you?
I'm good. It's always good to have you in the studio. I'm excited that you're here.
So thank you so much.
Coming. Especially on this lovely 200,000 degree day we're having.
It's blistering.
It's special, isn't it? New York City in the summer, baby. Yeah. We all forget. It's very sad.
So hot.
So, we're going to talk about dog training methods and how they've changed over the recent years from what they were for a really long time. So, let's start off with a really simple question. So, how did you get started as a dog trainer?
I knew I wanted to work with animals, but I didn't know exactly what that entailed. And I initially was fostering dogs, and then I got into wanting to train them and picked up a couple of books and started looking around and ended up with a very short kind of internship of sorts with a dog trainer, you know, at the local pet store. This was like 17 years ago, 18 maybe now, long time.
Yeah.
And I basically learned to imitate her.
Okay.
And there was a lot of information about that, the leader stuff, and it was all of that acting like the mother dog business. And it wasn't really enough for me. I knew I really had just learned kind of to imitate somebody, and I didn't really understand the mechanism of a lot of it at that time.
And so, when you were learning all of this stuff and you didn't feel like it was enough, what did you do to get more information regarding it?
Well, I did two things. One was I looked around on the internet. The internet was kind of, in a way, sort of very new then. I didn't know any other dog trainers except for this one person that I had learned from. I didn't come through a community like that. I just was on my own. So I started Googling stuff, although it wasn't called Googling yet. I don't remember which one it was, right? But it was so old and so long ago. And I found the association Association for Pet Dog Trainers, APDT, and they were having a conference or a mini conference, and I went to that because I thought, well, there's where, you know, dog trainers are going to be, and I have some friends in Chicago, and I'll go check that out.
Cool.
And while I was there, I saw a woman doing clicker training because I'd been weaned on the basic old, you know, talking about styles, the old traditional style of, you know, what I'd done when I was a kid too. When we took the dog to obedience school, it was, you know, the pack leader stuff and the choke collar and, you know, a lot of other things we can get into, but I started with that. And while I was at this conference, I saw someone doing clicker training, which is one of the styles that positive reinforcement sometimes takes. And I just had an epiphany that I didn't even know I was looking for.
Wow.
I just was like watching the dog interact with the human and the loop of communication between them, as opposed to just the exertion of one's will on the other.
Right.
And I still can't. It's hard to describe because I really didn't know there was another way. I wasn't looking for another way. I was just looking for more info. I didn't really have a bias about what I was doing at all.
Right.
Until I saw this. And I literally, in my head went, that is what I want to be doing. And
so how did you feel like when you saw this going on?
Well, I knew that was it. I was like, whatever she's doing, I want to do that. This is totally different. And it was hard because I learned a ton of stuff about that at the conference, and I came back, and I was in the middle of teaching a class at that point, you know, like one of the big box pet stores was out in California at the time. Yeah. And it was hard not to come back and say to my students, everything I told you was wrong.
Oh, God.
You know, that's what I felt like coming back going, everything I told you was wrong, and now we're going to do this. But I knew continuity-wise, it wasn't good for their psyche for me to come in and do that. So it was clearly already sort of a reinforcement person in my head. I was like, no, I can't punish them that way by, like, telling them everything we've done is wrong.
Yeah, but I'm really good. I swear to God.
Yeah, so totally. I, you know, and again, again, I had been training under a year. I was kind of trying it on, really, I think, about that point. And was only doing group classes, and which are, you know, fairly routinized. You can kind of get away with it if you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah.
Especially if you're kind of doing, especially if you're kind of not finessing it very well, which I certainly wasn't at that time. And, yeah, so I wanted to just tell them everything was wrong, but I couldn't. So I just kind of muscled through the end of that class, like really toning it down and trying to, like, without it being like a big obvious thing, like, now we're going to do this, and it's nice.
Nice.
Yeah. And then I was like, my classes are going to be clicker classes now. And there was no, oversight at this point how I was teaching. Nobody cared. Nobody paid attention.
Yeah.
I got a little tiny, tiny paycheck. It was just like my nighttime job at the time. And I remember I had to go, because I had to buy clickers on my own for my students to give to them, because they didn't have clickers at the big box store at that point.
It.
Nobody even knew about this. All you ever saw about clicker training, I remember, was in The Accidental Tourist. She was a dog trainer.
That's funny.
Do you remember that?
That's
she was
funny.
A dog trainer, and she was doing clicker training. And then there was one episode of House where there was clicker training, like 2 years, 4 years ago, maybe. But anyway, so blah, 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 very long story longer. And I started buying those little animal clickers you can get through Oriental Trading,
that little
magazine, and you could buy them by the 100 for like $20. So they break like every 20 minutes. But I was giving those out to my students and going, this is amazing, let's do this. And actually, out of those classes came some really amazing people that to this day still train their dogs. One of the gals that was one of my first students in one of those classes went on to compete really extensively with her dog in agility.
Oh, no way.
No, exactly.
Awesome.
And another gal went on and does all kinds of stuff with nose work and doesn't compete professionally, but still, you know, 17 years later, I talked to her on the phone even, and she's still training her dog.
That's really cool.
With that kind of stuff. And I wonder back, you know, what would have happened to those people if I hadn't switched kind of my tactics at that point.
It's a really, really good question. So tell us what the difference is between classical and operant conditioning.
Well, the difference between knowing the difference is whether you're really a dog trainer or not, in my opinion. You know, I've mentioned that before, that, you know, there's a lot of people that can call themselves whatever they want.
Yeah.
And when people say that, and it's a fairly aversive way of probably dealing with it, so I don't actually say this back to them, but in my head I'm like, yeah, if you can tell me the difference between classical and operant conditioning, then we'll talk, because then we're peers.
Yeah.
But if you can't, at its root, that's the basic mechanism to teach behavioral change to pretty much any organism. You know, you use classical and operant conditioning with fish, with sea mammals.
Really?
Yeah, with dogs, with cats, with my new foster rat I'm excited about.
Ooh.
It's the difference is that operant conditioning is a change in behavior that happens based on cause and effect.
Okay.
That it's about the behavior being rewarded or punished and increasing or decreasing.
Okay.
And then classical conditioning is what comes along for the ride. Classical conditioning is always happening.
Mm.
If there's operant conditioning, there's classical conditioning. And
okay.
There can be classical conditioning without operant conditioning necessarily. So classical conditioning is just the association between events.
Oh, okay.
So it always overrides things. Like if I'm teaching you, you know, just to sit down, let's say, I'm teaching you to sit down, and I'm, you know, paying you with dollar bills every time you sit down, you're like, that's exciting. Then you stand up and do something, and I'm like, why don't you have a seat, and you sit down. Or if we're talking about a dog, it doesn't matter. How and what's going on during that process is creating the classical conditioning.
Okay.
So it's, you know, if I'm doing bad things to teach, I get associated with the bad thing.
Okay.
And the room we're in gets associated with the bad thing.
Oh, wow.
And the act of performing gets associated with the bad thing. Even if the dog stops doing the bad thing because I'm punishing it, all these other associations about how that feels come along for the ride.
Wow.
And those are more likely to not be things that you want. So if I'm going to have something come along for the ride with my training, I'd rather it be something that's going to work well for me, that's going to make my dog better about stuff.
Totally.
Like if I'm teaching him to sit, and in the room is a little kid, and I'm using treats, my dog's going to not necessarily immediately feel better about little kids, but it's not going to make him feel worse about them.
That's like, true.
Every time we come to this crazy room, I get lots of treats for sitting.
Totally.
Yeah, but if I wanted to put a really narrow light on it, I would just be like, a kid came into the room, and you can have some treats.
Mm-hmm.
And then the kid left.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the difference. Classical and operant conditioning. Operant is the change in behavior, or it's the cause and effect happening
Okay.
between a behavior and a reward or punishment. And then classical conditioning is the association between events. So it's not contingent on behavior. A buzzer goes off and you get cheese.
Right.
Like that's, you know, that's the Pavlovian thing. He wasn't training them to do anything. Yeah. A bell happens and you get food.
Yeah.
And because of that, in that case, you know, there was the salivation thing and they could measure that. And the animal started to behave differently when they heard the bell.
Mm.
But it wasn't about them having a behavior rewarded or punishment. The behavior came along for the ride because they felt good and anticipated food.
Right.
And the bell got associated with food, so they had the same response to it. So that was your classical conditioning, basically,
right, cool.
There.
That's a great explanation. Thank you. Because I've always been a little confused on those two.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about fear.
Oh, okay. Let's talk about that.
Fear. Yay. We talk about fear on this show all the time.
Really?
Yeah, we do. Because I think a lot of it is, you know, misunderstanding of communication between animals and people. And, you know, oh, they're being bad. No, they're scared. That kind of thing. So
yeah. Yeah. We as humans get really hung up on the cause and effect.
Yeah.
And we don't look at the driver of the behavior in a lot of these cases. You know, animals have things that they do when they're afraid.
Yeah.
Those things are dangerous to us. We don't like them.
Yeah.
But those are often the dog's warning signs before they react super aggressively, and they can't really stop it if they feel afraid.
Yeah.
I mean, we can suppress it for a while, but fear finds a way out, and that's a big problem, because there's a big difference in how people who aren't savvy enough with the operant classical conditioning yet, maybe, or don't understand about suppression of fear-based behaviors, what's going to happen in that case long-term, potentially.
Yeah, and I think that that's something that's really, really important, because there are a couple trainers that were pretty famous in the past few years that worked this way, you know, and it's like, look, dog's behaving, but it's like, dog's got PTSD.
Yeah.
Dog's a train wreck.
Yeah, yeah. He who shall not be named.
Yes, please.
Has, you know, a history of, again, you just look at the outward behavior that you're like, the dog is acting aggressive, and you come back at it with that, he's not respecting me, mumbo jumbo,
right. Or
he's acting aggressively and I have to get rid of that, basically. Like, we don't like growling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I always talk about growling with clients and explain it like, growling is your dog's warning. It is him basically in dog language going, please don't make me bite you.
Yeah.
I'm uncomfortable with this. I don't like this. And we can coulda, woulda, shoulda, and he should, and why doesn't he understand all we want? But his reaction is guttural and primal.
Totally.
And he can't control it. It's like a reflex. It's like if I take a swing at you and you flinch.
Yeah.
And then I, you know, make fun of you for that or something. You couldn't really control the flinch. It was a response you had. It was a reflex. And I can't punish out, really. I can punish out what looks like the fear,
right?
But it's not really gone. It's like taking a time bomb and throwing a blanket over it and going, I don't hear the ticking, so everything's okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's like, no, it's not. You didn't defuse the bomb.
Yeah.
And that's what happens when you punish out some of these behaviors, whether it's you don't support the avoidance behavior and you force your dog and flood them into a situation and they get worse.
Yeah.
Or if you try to punish, whether it's collar corrections or whether it's a shock collar or whether it's you know, just yelling at them, even if that were to work, which it might in mild situations, but it's still suppression of the warning system. And the warning system is really important.
It really is. I mean, it reminds me of, like, I knew someone growing up who didn't have the best parents in the world. And she was terrified of thunder and lightning. And every time it would happen, she'd flip out and, like, hide in her bed under the covers and stuff. And the parents would come in and, like, scream at her and be like, why are you scared? You know, and this is like, needless to say, it led into problems as adulthood. And we were talking about all of this. And it's kind of the same thing with, you know, if you think about it, like, if your dog is, like, cringing in the corner for fireworks or whatever, and you're like, what's wrong with you? It's not helping.
No, it's absolutely. Not, you know? It's like trying to smack someone into not sweating.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? It's like, why are you nervous? And now you're sweating. You know how objectionable I find that. You know, why can't you just be scared and keep it to yourself?
Totally.
And I'm just going to smack you till you stop sweating. It's least, you know, I mean, I may be able to, if it was a behavior that was actually under your control, get you to not do it, but it's going to come out again somewhere else.
And that's I mean, could this go into behaviors of, like, I know with, like, for her, for example, she wound up being a bedwetter for years.
So
could this be something like, you know?
Well, absolutely. I mean, there's stories, you know, all over the place, and half of what's difficult is that a lot of times you seemingly get away with doing it, and you don't, if you don't look for where it went, you may not see it.
Right.
And then later, like, I'm sure her parents didn't go, we made you a bedwetter.
No.
A psychologist might very well, yeah, because they have the mechanism to untangle the knot.
Yeah.
And that's the problem, basically.
No, she got punished more, actually, because of it. It was a horrible, horrible spiral.
It's not unlike dog stuff.
No, and it's, this is the thing, too, is I think that people, you know, we like to think as human beings that we're, like, so much smarter than all the animals. And, I mean, okay, we have math, you know, we do things like that. So we're smarter, I guess, I don't know, in certain things, but, like, animals know what they need to know.
Yeah, and then why is it that, you know, if we're smarter, and I tell clients this all the time, I'm like, we have the opposable thumbs and the bigger brain. If it was a contest, we win number one just on that.
Totally.
Why is it still considered okay, ethical, and preferred to trot out forceful, aggressive methods when there are other ones that will work?
Yeah.
And they're so counterindicated in so many situations.
Mm.
You know, you could make a case for something very aversive, like a shock collar, to proof of recall, perhaps. Like,
yeah.
I would at least go, okay, that's at least an ethical use of it that will probably work. I won't take the risk on of the side effects that are going to happen from that.
Right.
And nor is it who I want to be to do that,
yeah,
to any dog. But at least you've got your stuff lined up behaviorally, as opposed to someone going, when my dog growls or lunges, I'm going to wallop them.
Totally.
That is not going to make the problem go away in any safe or meaningful way for the dog,
mm,
or for the public to be safe. And I, beyond the, you know, Pollyanna, happy, ethical, I don't want aggressive stuff in my life reasons, I won't take the liability on of that. I won't do that to your dog, because I don't know what that's going to make happen.
Mm, good point.
And I think it could be spun any number of ways when other crappy or dangerously lethal bad behaviors come out,
yeah,
later, because they come out later.
Totally.
And it's hard for people, again, like if you're not a psychologist, like with the daughter child,
yeah,
to be able to unweave it. But I unweave it a lot now, and I see it more and more. The story I explain to people a lot, one of the stories I know is a client from way back, was at their house to help them with something totally unrelated, but they at one point said, yeah, and our dog does this really strange thing. When the microwave dings or we use a digital thermometer and it buzzes that it's over, the dog freaks out and runs under the bed. And
oh,
I'm
God.
Like, and I'm like, well, that is unusual. That's weird. Okay, let's move on, because that wasn't like the problem that I was there for, and it wasn't even related really to the problem. It was secondary. But then later they were talking, and they mentioned that they have an electronic fence upstate.
Well,
and I was like, oh, literally, ding, ding, ding.
Totally.
That's what's happening. Your
wow.
dog, and this is when you have classical conditioning, it overrides the operant.
Yeah.
The fence dings and shocks, you know, which they'll euphemize and call, you know, in all the all those collars, they'll call it a stimulation.
Yes.
A vibration.
Yeah.
It's like a tap. It's not. If for it to work, it's strong
it
enough
hurts.
That your dog is looking to actively avoid it at all consequences.
Totally.
And so what you don't know what comes along for the ride, but the classical conditioning stuff comes along for the ride. So that dog had also learned that when you hear a bell, which is the warning bell to not go into the
mm-hmm.
yard part, you're going to get shocked.
Ugh.
So when it happened out of context, it didn't matter. The dog had generalized it in its head because it was so aversive to it. It was so scary
wow.
that his brain said, avoid this everywhere, all the time,
totally.
At all costs.
Totally.
And
well,
you
we
don't
need
know.
To take a quick break. I hate cutting you off, but we need to take a really quick break for station identification. We'll be back in about a minute and a half, 2 minutes, and we're going to continue the conversation with Denise Herman of Empire of the Dog.
Out there, it's Steve Jenkins. I'm with Fairway Markets. White Leghorn, Red Wattle, Bourbon Red, Navajo Churro. Well, these aren't names you're likely to hear at a Fairway butcher counter or any other counter today, but before the rise of factory farming, you would have. And at Heritage Foods USA, you still do. Heritage Foods USA exists to promote genetic diversity, small family farms, and a fully traceable food supply. You see, we believe the best way to help a family farmer is to buy from them. And Heritage Foods is honored to represent a network of family farmers and artisanal producers whose work presents an immeasurable gift to our food system and to biodiversity. The meat we celebrate, whether it's heritage turkey, Japanese steaks, Berkshire pork, or Navajo churro lamb chops, is the righteous kind from healthy animals of sound genetics that have been treated humanely and allowed to pursue their natural instincts. It's a simple fact. Animals raised according to this philosophy taste better. And as we like to say, you have to eat them to save them. Visit us at heritagefoodsusa.com for more information.
This is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
And we are back. I am talking to Denise Herman all about punishment training and the repercussions. She is the owner and lead trainer at Empire the Dog in Brooklyn. If you've got a dog and you need a trainer, give her a call. She's amazing. Anyway, Denise, let's talk about pack theory. What do you think about that? Of like, you know, you're the parent, and so when your dog's bad, you need to bite him in the ear and behave like a dog parent.
Well, you know, the pack theory stuff has been really honestly debunked now so many times.
Okay.
There's a couple problems with it. I mean, one is that it always calls for pretty impressively aversive training things. Like, it legitimizes a lot of things that are pretty gnarly things. And then the other part of it that I personally object to as much is, and this is how I talk to clients about it, is that a lot of the things it's telling you to do are not going to make the problem better. They're definitely, a lot of them, going to make it worse.
Mm.
And the rest of it's just garbage that's wasting your time, getting your dog to go in and out of doors behind you or walk behind you. Is all sort of just garbagey stuff that's not going to affect anything except going in and out of doors and walking behind you. And I might say to them, you might want to have control of your dog over at the door, because it's dangerous if he bolts through or it's unpleasant to you. But going through it first is not teaching him anything else unrelated to the door. Train him to wait at the door nicely and to go when you let him know that he can go, but it's not going to affect guarding in your bed or anything else that's happening that's not related to the door. But it's prescribed for everything from, you know, house training to chewing to everything, because everything comes down, when pack theory people talk about it, it all comes down to you're just not being leadery enough. And it's sort of emperor's new clothes in that respect, that it all just gets dumped on you as far as you're just not being leadery enough. You know, you're not projecting a calm, assertive demeanor, or whatever that garbage is.
It's a little serial killer, though. You know, if you're like really calm and you're still like really punishing and stuff, it's a little like, oh, they're kind of crazy.
That's funny. Yeah. Well, there's a book that's one of my favorite books called The Sociopathic Store, which I really like. It's a great book for spotting really divisive people that are sociopathic in your life. And one of the things it says in there, and it's like, it's just a line from it, and it says, fear masquerades brilliantly as respect.
Oh, wow.
And that's true in human situations
as
well. And with dogs, you know, they're pretty much intertwined. You're doing all these things. Your dog's not capable of the ideal of respect, but you have a dog that looks a little afraid of you, and then you call it respect, you know, that happens.
Oh, it's so ego.
And So that's the main crux of it. But the pack stuff, you know, from a science perspective, it's all been completely debunked. All of this basically was distilled from one wolf study where they took a bunch of random wolves and put them together in captivity that were once wild. This guy Meech, David Meech, I think his first and last name, David Meech. And even he has come out and going, yeah, I've been watching actual wolves more. They don't do that.
Oh,
He's totally, you know, taken his hands off it as well.
Good.
And gone, no, those studies were totally not right, because all of those wolves did have battles, I think, and were doing aggressive things to each other. They were heavily stressed.
Mm.
They weren't familial
all.
And the hierarchical nature of wolves is very much like the hierarchical nature in a family.
Mm.
It's parents and their offspring.
Yeah.
And they're not fighting with their offspring. When the group gets too big or it can't, you know, do stuff effectively, they split off and form other packs and go find other territories and whatnot.
Mm.
But the hierarchy isn't kept through aggressive displays.
Right.
And also, dogs aren't wolves.
True.
They're not. So you can't even extrapolate that hierarchical nature to domestic dogs. It's just pointless.
Do you think basically dogs are to wolves as like chimps are to humans? Like, is it that far spread?
I think that it's fair enough, maybe, to say that. I mean, I can't think of a better one offhand.
Yeah.
You know, but I think that it's fair enough to say it's that far removed.
Because I think that everyone's like, it looks like a wolf, so they're
Yeah, well, they've got,
the wolf,
you know, I mean, that know? Lady that said, well, I'm going to take a chimp and dress it up in diapers and keep it like a pet / child, and it did attacked her face,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, like ripped her face off, yeah.
And you know, no offense, obviously, to her. That's a tragic situation, but it's lacking the basic understanding that wild animals
and
domestic versions of said, or, you know, not even more evolved, but differently evolved, yeah, like humans, they're not the same anymore.
No. Not at all. It's kind of creepy, isn't it? So, choke and pinch collars, your other favorite subject.
Oh, gosh.
Actually, here's a question for you regarding them.
Yeah.
Let's say you've got someone, okay, they've got it's a client, maybe a new client you're talking to, and they've got a really aggressive dog, and there's all kinds of problems, and their thing is, like, if we don't use the prong collar, the dog's going to have to be put to sleep. Like, what's the story with that?
Well, I don't know if I hear that direct thing. I would certainly tease it out and go, what does that mean to you?
Yeah.
I started dog training in a time where the only anti-pull thing really out there was the prong collar.
Mm.
I'd used it for sure. And right when I started dog training, they invented the gentle leader, which was a game changer.
Yeah, totally.
And people like to, you know, people who would rather use the prong might poo-poo the gentle leader and be like, it's causing all of this other problem. There haven't been any studies that I know of to support that at this point. And certainly anything could be, you know, misused.
Yeah.
But the gentle leader stands alone as one of the least physically aversive things, certainly. The dog may not tolerate it right away.
Mm-hmm.
You have to condition them, some of them, to wear it a little bit comfortably. But it's not a painful device.
True.
You know, it changes the leverage point. I've been pulled down a hill towards the highway on my stomach. That's my old story. By two dogs on pinch collars.
Oh, my God.
Like 15 years ago. Hi, Dr. Jesse. That was your dogs. In case I'll make her listen to this. I'm like, remember Sherman and her beagle, Billy Jim Bob? And they pulled me down a hill on their pinch collars.
Holy crap.
Towards the highway. And that was before the gentle leader was available. They had just habituated to the collars. It just wasn't, you know, a thing to them even anymore at that point.
Wow.
But the problem with those is you still get the operant and classical conditioning. So I put the collar on. It stops the behavior of pulling, because when they pull, it applies pressure.
Yeah, it hurts.
Which, you know, hurts them. You know, we can make the case to varying degrees. Say what you want. If you put it on, it doesn't work. That's because it's not hurting that dog. And good for that dog.
Seriously.
But otherwise, so you get the operant behavior of the pulling stops. But suppose the dog was pulling because he really likes other dogs.
Yeah.
So every time he sees a dog, he starts to, like, increase his momentum. But then he stops because it hurts.
Yeah.
What is the biggest visual, physical connector he's connecting to that pain?
Oh, God, other dogs.
Yeah, other dogs. And, you know, if you put that on an adolescent dog or a young dog, especially where they're making these early formative associations, they don't have anything to offset it, you know, like no good experiences or no at least baseline there, then you really risk a high percentage of those dogs, or a percentage that I'm not willing to mess with and gamble with, your dog, that's going to develop leash aggression and a negative association to dogs when on leash. And we know, because we hear this all the time from people, that dogs, there's so many dogs who are terribly reactive or aggressive on leash, but off at the dog park, they're fine.
Yeah,
it doesn't happen there.
Totally.
And there's lots of reasons that can happen. I'm not laying this squarely at the feet of prong collars. There's lots of reasons that happens. But it's at least partially related to the way dogs can't moderate space, and or if they've had an aversive collar, I can go, that's certainly not helping.
Mm-hmm.
Because that classical conditioning is at risk of coming along for the ride, importantly to your dog. And you know, I had an experience like this with my dog. She traveled, I've told you the story a little bit, my dog traveled. My dog was the queen of having one bad experience and generalizing it rapidly.
Oh.
So I traveled with her in a car, and we had a terrible vet visit once, and it was very aversive for her. She was terrified. And she was car sick for 6 months after that.
Oh, my God.
And she had traveled cross country in the car. She had traveled back and forth to work with me for 6 months. So it wasn't like she didn't have a lot of car experience under her belt.
Yeah.
But it was so aversive that, you know, that was the biggest thing she associated with it was last time I got in the car, everything really sucked.
Oh, God. Yeah, really. It was terrible.
And so
these
things happen. And if people, and especially you shouldn't call yourself a dog trainer, obviously, if you aren't aware of the classical conditioning for better and for worse, you have no business doing it, really.
No, and it's the thing is too, this is a real profession. This is, you have to study, you have to learn. Just because you can make your dog sit doesn't mean you're a trainer.
Exactly. And that kind of brings us to the change in the training methods that more and more people are choosing positive methods, and certainly more and more people who are getting the information and getting educated and putting books and science behind their schooling for dog training are choosing to not do more heavy-handed aversive things because they know what they're risking. It's kind of like just going into it blind. Like, you know, if you don't know anything about science and I tell you about gravity, you're going to throw an apple in the air and go, there's no gravity. Look what I can do.
Totally.
Because you just might not understand the mechanism behind it.
Yeah.
And it's trainers' jobs to explain that to owners. I don't expect them to know the mechanism behind it.
No.
And I think it's negligent when people sell the general public things like prong collars, shock collars, really aversive training devices, and tell them it's going to be fine.
And now, are those things legal, like, all over the world, or are we just,
they're illegal in a lot of places.
Really?
At this point, shock collars, certainly.
Good.
Denmark, Germany, Switzerland, Slovenia, Austria, maybe Finland, and there was a big push to ban them in the UK, and I don't know if that's gone to a vote yet or if it's happened.
Well, that'll pass because the UK is so good about animal welfare and all that kind of stuff, so that'll happen.
Yeah. There's a lot of places that are going, you know, it's a dangerous thing. And the more education people have, if you look at PhD behaviorists, if you look at anyone who studied behavior and has gone to actual, like a university for it, and the people, the bigger heads than mine, even. I'm not a big giant head. I don't have a PhD.
Yeah.
But the people that do are really clear about the fallouts of this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So I think that's a telling point that should encourage people to try to tone it down.
I love that there's science behind this too. So it's not just all like, well, this is what Joe said, you know. It's like, no, this is actually proven. Like, they've done this.
Well, that was the big thing for me as well. When I was trying to learn dog training, it seemed like everything was sort of so nebulous and I was never going to understand it all. And when I learned about operant classical conditioning and animal behavior and, you know, big nerdy speak, like the quadrants of punishment and reinforcement, I was like, oh, this is great. Now I know how to build the equation. Like, I know the rules of the equation. And I can look at any problem, and knowing the rules, I can build out a personalized equation for the dog. Like, what is it they like? What is it they're trying to get? What are they not like? What are they trying to avoid? And how bad is it? And let's play with thresholds of exposure, and let's do counter conditioning. And, you know, one of the big things, and I'll throw this out there because we've talked about this and we haven't said it yet today, is that people still are concerned about, and I understand, but trainers should have their heads behind this more, is that even if a dog is having a fearful reaction, you're not going to make it worse by trying to relax them, by giving them food, by talking to them, by taking them a little bit, backing out a little bit, because the classical conditioning will always override the operant. You cannot make them be more aggressive by giving them treats if they're barking and upset about something.
Right.
But giving it to them and getting to a calm level doesn't mean you need to, like, now we need to go further, because you have to play with this a little bit. You have to finesse it. When I go into people's houses and they tell me their dog is afraid of strangers or new people or anything like that, when I first come in, they're absolutely barking most of the time.
Yeah.
And I have treats and I start throwing them on the floor and not being more provocative.
Yeah.
Letting the dog calm down and doing the treats lavishly, not asking him to sit, not asking him to be quiet, nothing behavioral. It's just, here I am, big scary new person, and here a food bar is open. La 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 la. And I sit down and then I throw some more food and I'm like, la 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 la. And I talk to the owner and the first thing I say is, how is that compared to how it normally is? Because by this point, many times the dog's already stopped barking.
Wow.
They're not ready for me to, like, pet them and, you know, all that stuff. It's it's a terrible joke. I'm always like, I was like, you can buy a girl a drink, but you don't get to grope her. You know, the dog is taking the treats, but so many people think I gave the dog a treat. Now I can just put them.
Yeah, now we're
and
friends.
It's like, no, dogs should be allowed to consent.
Totally.
But I ask, so I get in and I throw the treats and I do all that. And the dogs are usually very, much better by that point. I say to the owner, how is this compared to your normal?
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, that is so much better.
Wow.
Like they're so much quieter, so much quicker, so much better looking.
Mm-hmm.
And I've made my point. I don't have to kind of spell it out as much for people. Then I'm like, see, this, if those other rules were true, this dog should be more upset and barking at me more.
True.
But he's not.
So the, like in your years of training, because you've definitely trained dogs with like the original methods and the modern methods. Mm-hmm. Now, are you finding that the modern methods are, I don't know, what kind of dog are you getting out of both results? You know what I mean? Are you getting a better dog out of the positive reinforcement? Are you getting...
To be fair, I was not a very finessed trainer before all of this.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting to note that trainers who have switched from one to the other, uh-huh. regardless of how long they did more what they call aversive training, and they call punishment training or more aversive training. And aversive just meaning that it's a punishment that works off of fear or avoidance or startling.
Mm-hmm.
Shake, can, spray, bottle, shock, collar, any of those things.
Yeah.
You know, that pokey thing to the side. I don't understand how people don't go, he's kicking dogs. How does everyone not see that?
I'm amazed that nobody, that he's getting bit.
Yeah. Well, he has, I'm sure.
Oh, okay, good.
I mean, I've seen video where, yeah, there's some crazy video. But you know, that and you know, don't get me started. So, but the interesting thing is that regardless of how long people have done, you know, some of the more aversive stuff, when people switch over, they never go back.
That's cool.
It's not like they try the other on typically and go, oh, I don't want to do that. And most of the I was reading some research a while ago, and even that showed that when you compare and contrast the two, it may be that the learning happens in both situations as mm-hmm. far as teaching to do something or not to do something,
mm-hmm.
but it's what is the side effect? And they look at the dogs and they can quantify now more so whether it's tests of their cortisol levels or whether it's just looking at them behaviorally. One of these was they had three groups of dogs trained. The first two groups, one group had only training through shock collars with the people who knew what they were doing,
okay.
but used it that way, as far as I understand. Second group was they used shock collar and reinforcement. It was mm-hmm. the same trainers because they knew how to use the shock collars. The third group was just people using trainers using reinforcement. And all of the groups learned, it seemed like their responses came out fairly similar as far as how they learned. But the first two groups had a definite thing that they noticed where they didn't want to be closer than 5 feet to their trainer.
Oh, wow.
And then one article I saw about this, it did a correlation causation thing and said, oh, but because the trainers were the same, it was probably about the trainers, not about the method.
Right.
But the method and the trainer can't be separated.
No, it can't be different.
Because that's the classical conditioning.
Yeah.
The method is the trainer. Yeah. They're linked together. They represent the same thing in the dog's head because the classical conditioning comes along for the ride, whether you want it to or not. It's like if you learn to dance really well, but you have one really punitive instructor, one really nice instructor. Where are you going to go to practice or to learn a new step if you have the choice?
Especially like, what are you doing? What are you, stupid? And it's like, I'm learning this. I don't know what I'm doing. I mean, I've had trainers on both sides, you know, and like, there's nothing like, if you know what you're doing and everything's good and you know you're messing up and you get yelled at, that's a different story than like, you know, walking into a room and being like, what are you, stupid? And you're wait, what?
Well, that's one of the things that, you know, is used sometimes to sell the shock collars is, well, I put it on myself and tested it.
Oh, like, that's such bullshit.
But you knew that you could at any point leave the experiment. You knew you could stop it, and you knew why it was happening. You know, dogs who get it punished and the training is, the timing is very bad or off in those cases, or it's just repetitive. It's not calm submission. It's learned helplessness. The dog is literally like jello going, I don't want to do anything. I'm not going to do anything because nothing's working.
Yeah.
You know?
And I mean, anyone that's ever put those collars on and has shocked themselves are horrified and are like, oh my God, I can't believe I bought this. And they don't use them.
And that's one of the bigger problems too. And why a lot of places are looking to ban and outlaw them, which I think they should, is that the compliance to the general public, they're not going to get someone hired to come in there. They think it's a quick fix and they're going to ruin their dog.
Yeah, buzz,
or make it
buzz,
more
buzz.
Dangerous or Jesus. Terrible than it started out. They've done research on that and people, the one of the worst parts of it was that they just didn't even read the manual. They didn't even know.
Are you kidding?
You know? Well, and I had a client, and it's not their fault exactly either. It shouldn't be sold to them like that. I had a client who had a deaf dog, and and some of these collars also vibrate, but because of the euphemisms that are used to describe it, some of them will say it's like a vibration. It might be like a vibration. You want to say that, but it is not an actual vibration.
No, it's not like
So they had sold this to her, and it was a shock collar, and she was going to use it on her dog. I think she'd maybe just barely started, and I was like, "Well, where is the? I don't know. This looks like a shock collar. I didn't want one that even had the shocking component because it's too easy, I think, to get it confused." Mm. And I put it on my arm and had her push the thing. And I'm like, "No, it's shocking me."
Oh my
I was
God.
Like, "Did you put that on her?" And she was told explicitly at the store because she asked them explicitly, "I don't want a shock collar." But I don't know if some of the people at some of the bigger stores even know.
No, I don't think
that
they
they're
do.
Not trained. They look at it and says, "Oh, look, this is." It says it's a vibration that trains them.
Exactly.
And that is not the same.
Exactly.
And so it's just bad all around.
Okay. Well, sadly, we are out of time. Denise, I would love to talk to you about this for more time because it's such an important topic. But I love what we've covered. I think it's great. And I want to say thank you for coming in again. I love having you here.
You're welcome. I love being here.
Where can people find you if they want to talk more about this kind of stuff or get their dog trained by you, that kind of thing?
Oh, they can find me at empireofthedog.com. And I think that's right now one of the only.
That's a good start.
Yeah, that's the way to go. There's a really nice blog I like in a group called Fearful Dogs.
Oh, nice.
Fearfuldogs.com. I think it might be the website. And they actually also have a page on Facebook. They've got some nice info there about how to deal because basically, you know, aggression is coming out almost all the time because of fear, anxiety, avoidance. And you need to get someone who's going to help you or provide support that's not going to make it worse.
Totally. Totally. Well, I just wanted to say that what's going on over here is I wanted to say thank you for today's show. And Liz Smith is the engineer. Liz is awesome. She always makes me look good. I adore working with her. Thank you so much, Liz. Today's break music was provided by Mama Rosie. And my show's theme song is Never Coming Home by the Raunch Hands. It's a pretty cool album if you're into that kind of stuff. And also, thank you, listener, for tuning in. If you liked what you heard, please tell your friends to subscribe. And you can subscribe on iTunes. Feel free to get in touch with us at theheritageradionetwork.org. Next up, we have a teaser clip of Chef Marco Canora sharing some snack hacks on the food scene. Another great show found right here on Heritage Radio Network. Thank you guys for listening, and I'll talk to you next week. Take care.
There's so much misinformation out there, and everybody thinks that eating well needs to be surrounded with deprivation. And it's like, it's not deprivation at all. Like, I'm a fucking hedonist.
Chef Marco Canora shares some snack hacks on episode 226 of The Food Scene, hosted by Michael Harlan Turkel.
I love food. I eat food like crazy. I don't need to be hungry to eat food. It is just like a huge part of my life. And, you know, a lot of people are afraid of this idea of eating well because they think that you turn your back on all that stuff. And no, it doesn't mean you turn your back on loving food. It just means you have to educate yourself and think differently about it.
So when you think of popcorn, do you instantly think, oh, that's fiber. That's going to clear me out.
Yes, I think about popcorn and then I say, well, let's make sure I put the right fat on it. And let's make sure, you know, I'm getting a good quality popcorn that's not some kind of highly mass-produced GMO popcorn. And then it's great popcorn, and I'll grate some really good pecorino cheese on it and put a boatload of black pepper on it and put a big hunk of really good grass-fed butter on it and some nice sea salt. And, man, it's fucking delicious, decadent popcorn that I could eat a tub of it until I'm sick. And I'm not going to feel so bad about it, right?
Because of you now cachu y pepeing something is like a verb in our house.
Right.
We always have that hunk of pecorino.
This was an excerpt from episode 226 of The Food Scene, hosted by Michael Harlan Turkel. Did you like it? The Food Scene episodes are available on our website or on iTunes. Dig in for more. This piece was brought to you by Bonnie Plants, bonnieplants.com.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.